Welcome to PRN's Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. My guest today is James Fetzer. Jim is a prolific writer. We're going to talk about stuff he's written. I hope I get the number of books right this time. I think the last time I had Jim on, I undercounted the number of books he's written. I think it's 29. My goodness, I've got 26 to go to catch up to him. But he is an extraordinary man. He's an expert on 9/11. He's founder for Scholars for 9/11 Truth. It's a very important initiative. Jim is an expert on 9/11. He's also an expert on a lot of other topics, including a few I know nothing about. His field, what he taught for many, many years at the University of Minnesota in Duluth. We won't go into those things on the philosophy of science and computer science and artificial intelligence and cognitive science. I don't know beans about those subjects, but Jim is an expert on those. We're going to talk about three topics today. One that I do know a good deal about. I've written about it. I've written much on two issues, the so-called Iranian nuclear talks and what they really mean and where they may be heading, and the interim agreement that was reached last November heading toward the possibility of a permanent agreement, or will there even be one, or is the whole thing an elaborate hoax? And the other big issue that I've written many times about, well, more than one big issue, but another big one is the war in Syria. Indeed. Well, we just had the second round of so-called peace talks wrap up. There wasn't much talking either side to the other, either on Friday, and I think there was supposed to be a Saturday session. I think it ended up being a no-session session. We'll talk about that. They ended in deadlock, really the way they began, and I've written so many articles on the Syrian story. I have another one in mind. There's no question that Washington thwarted these talks, torpedoed them, preordained them to fail. What happens next, I don't know. You could have as many rounds of talks as you want, but if one party wants peace and the other does not want peace, in other words, wants war, and I'm not talking about the delegates, the so-called Syrian National Council delegates in Geneva. I'm not talking about them. They're U.S. stooges. They have no legitimacy whatsoever. Their lips move, and Washington policy comes out. That's what it's all about. So if Washington wants war, there'll be war. If Washington wants peace, there'll be peace. We've had war raging for almost 3 years. Obama launched it. It was planned long before Obama came into office. The name of the game is regime change. It's replacing independent sovereign governments with pro-Western puppet ones. That's what the deal is all about. Washington plays this dirty game lots of different ways. Coup d'etats, political assassinations, not political ones, real assassinations, you know, cold-blooded murder. And if all other methods fail, well, Obama is waging proxy war against Syrians who want peace. And the leader of Syria, Bashar al-Assad, he's the victim. And the Syrian people are victims, yet he gets blamed for the crimes these cold-blooded killers are committing. And every time you hear somebody talk about the civil war in Syria, they either don't know what they're talking about or they're lying. I've explained in detail several times, there is absolutely nothing civil about the war in Syria, aside from it being uncivil. It is not, I repeat, not a civil war. It's a foreign invasion. These death squad killers, supported, armed, funded, trained by CIA operatives, by U.S. Special Forces, a lot of Saudi money involved, a lot of Qatari money involved, Jordan is involved, Turkey is involved, Britain is involved, France is involved, America is the lead actor. I think Saudi Arabia is kicking in the most money, certainly has enough of it. deprives its own people of virtually everything they could easily have if the Saudis were a reasonable state, which they are not. But they are very much involved in this, including supplying chemical weapons to these people. And U.S. Special Forces, possibly CIA people, are training these death squad killers in Jordan to use chemical weapons. Multiple chemical weapons attacks, falsely blamed on Assad. No evidence whatever proving it. Plenty of evidence proving these death squad terrorists did it. Well, we'll talk about the Syrian situation, the Iranian situation. Another big, we'll talk about 9/11 at the end of the program. Jim has written several very important articles on the Sandy Hook incident over a year ago. We definitely want to get into that. We'll make that the second topic. The article that I like best that Jim wrote, 10 Reasons Explaining That Sandy Hook, everybody knows Sandy Hook. Sandy Hook was an elaborate hoax. False flag, the language, well, I use false flag language all the time, and the other language I love to use is the big lie, capital B, capital L. Don't believe everything you read in the papers. Don't believe everything you hear on television, and the images they show. Believe nothing they show. Believe nothing they say. Managed news, misinformation, bald-faced lying. That's what it is. Jim, welcome.
Oh, Stephen, thank you, thank you. I agreed with everything you were saying about the Syrian peace talks and all that. I mean, what a charade, ultimately, when one side, the opposition, insists as a precondition to holding these negotiations that President Assad must step down, thereby seeking to win at the conference what they cannot win on the ground. I mean, it's ridiculous, and as you are astutely observing, these rebels are being sponsored by Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Israel, anyone but the indigenous Syrian people. It's outrageous and a disgrace.
Well, Jeff, I left out Israel in this equation. Absolutely. And it's very important to know that Israel borders on Syria, as does Lebanon, as does Iraq, as does Turkey. So, you know, the arms come in from Jordan, the arms come in from Jordan, the arms come in from Israel, the arms come in from Turkey, Saudi money, U.S. planning, a very dirty game, Jim.
Oh, you're so right, Stephen, and I'm so pleased that you're keeping the spotlight on Syria, where I can only hope, too, as I know you share my concern, that the diplomatic negotiations with Iran to bring about a solution to a non-existent problem, because as we both know, our own intelligence agencies, all 16, converged in the conclusion that Iran was not pursuing a nuclear weapons program in 2007, a conclusion that they reaffirmed in 2011. I don't understand, Stephen, how the U.S. foreign policy can be so grossly at odds with our own intelligence agencies' finding about a sensitive issue like this.
It is so true, Jim. I think every year there is an annual assessment by the combined 16 U.S. intelligence agencies. And I always say 16 known intelligence agencies. For all I know, there are 16 more we never heard of. I mean, who ever heard of a country with 16 intelligence agencies? But America has one, has them. And James Clapper, the acknowledged perjurer before Congress, is head of national
intelligence. He's the head of the intel because he's the biggest liar of them all, Stephen.
Absolutely. he admitted he committed perjury, but don't
That's
expect
a primary
to see
qualification.
Him.
The bigger the liar, the further you go in Washington, D.C.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, the Syrian debacle goes on, Jim, and the talks wrapped up. Round two of the talks wrapped up, I think sometime this morning, Geneva time, getting absolutely nowhere. You could call it deadlock. I call it preordained Washington plan failure. I mean, that's what it's all about. Obama wants regime change. If you resolve the conflict peacefully, then, you know, the Syrians will have at least some say in who's going to lead them, and they're certainly not going to allow pro-Western people are running their country. They deplore them. And the polls all show, if they have a legitimate election, which they had last year, I believe, lose track of my dates, I've written so often on Syria, but they had a legitimate election independently monitored, and the Assad's party won pretty convincingly, overwhelmingly, with an allied political group. But opposition people won seats in Syria's parliament. There was a new constitution that was adopted. It was first put to a national referendum, and Syrians voted on it, and there were changes made based on what Syrians had to say, and a final draft came out, and Syrians got to vote on that. Can you imagine Americans getting a chance to vote on a constitution, Jim?
Oh, I know, Stephen. We're so past. We're in post-constitutional America. It's unreal. And led by a former professor of constitutional law and a graduate of the Harvard School of Law. How obscene is that?
Oh, indeed so. I mean, not only a former law professor, but a constitutional law professor who I can't imagine anybody who is more unconstitutional, more a grievous lawbreaker and an international lawbreaker than Obama, and yet he fakes it with all of the duplicitous double talk that he gives, whether it's a speech or a comment or whatever. I think he's planning the war that was postponed last summer, at the end of August, beginning of September, Jim, when the mass public outrage got Obama, literally stopped Obama from intervening, because Congress was literally carpet bombed with anti-war emails and phone calls and stuff, and Republicans getting anti-war messages 100 to 1, 200 to 1, 300 to 1. I mean, these guys didn't dare vote for war. I mean, they were worried they wouldn't get reelected. So I don't think the war was called off. I think it was postponed, and I think Obama is planning, dare I say, another false flag as a pretext to launch it.
Stephen, I've never been more proud of the American people than for them to have put their foot down over the idea of lobbing cruise missiles into Syria, allegedly for the Syrian government's own violation of international law. When Obama would be responding by violating international law, he would have brought about many more casualties than died in the gas attack, where the gas attack had, of course, nothing to do with the Syrian government, was brought about by the rebels. Apparently, Bandar Bush, as he's known, of Saudi Arabia, facilitated their acquisition of those weapons.
Oh, indeed so. And there were barrels of stuff showing up in Syria with the label KSA on it. A kingdom of Saudi Arabia. I mean, there was stuff that was buried in tunnels. I really believe that Russia did some independent analysis and came up with evidence very similar to what Syria came up with. There's no question. Even a UN investigator, Carla Del Ponte, pretty much admitted that these so-called rebels were involved in at least one chemical weapons attack. But you'd never know it from the comments of John Kerry or Obama or the U.S. scoundrel media. I mean, the lies that proliferate and the truths that never get told. And again, I think we're heading for war, Jim, and it really concerns me. If these talks fail, and it looks like they will, Lakhdar Brahimi, the so-called intermediary, who really is a U.S. stooge, Washington appointed him. I mean, he's very diplomatic. He sounds good. He looks good. But he really isn't doing much. He's not accomplishing anything. As Kofi Annan, the former U.N. Secretary General, accomplished nothing before him. So I think the name of the game is fake the talks, be sure they fail, and have an excuse to blame it all on Assad. And Obama will say, well, you know, all options remain on the table, one of his favorite comments, and the lead option is to wage another war. And I'll be very surprised if it doesn't come. I must say, if two people deserve a Nobel Peace Prize, Jim, it's Vladimir Putin and Sergei Lavrov, Russia's foreign minister, because they have literally bent over backwards since the conflict began to prevent a greater war from breaking out.
I agree completely, Stephen, and in my opinion, the Russians will not allow Syria to fall, and if the U.S. attacks, it's going to initiate World War III, and it's going to be all-out and vicious, and we are going to be severely damaged. I mean, the continental United States, I would predict at least 10 million deaths of Americans if this goes forward.
It's a shocking idea, Jim, and I've mentioned many times in my article the possibility of a World War III. I mean, nobody thought there'd be the First World War or a second one. Is it so unreasonable to imagine there wouldn't be a third? I mean, this is the history of the world. You go from one war to another. America literally has a permanent war policy. Every single year in U.S. history, either at home and or abroad, America has been at war right through Obama's administration to this very day. He hasn't waged a single day of peace, not about one day of peace, nor did George Bush, and this dirty beat goes on. So it's very possible if there's an all-out war against Syria, it could involve Iran, it could involve Lebanon, it could involve Russia, and we literally could be on the cusp of World War III.
Oh, absolutely. I expect Iran would be immediately drawn into it too, Stephen. Did you know on the eve of Sochi that the Israelis launched another strike on Russian missiles in Syria? I think that had it not been for his preoccupation with the Olympics and not wanting to disrupt it, Putin would have retaliated then. But mark my words, he's going to do something about this. He will not take this line down.
I hope he'll do something about it. I don't agree with all of his policies, especially economic ones, but he certainly is a bulwark against U.S. imperialism, and he believes what you and I believe, Jim. International law is sacrosanct. It's inviolable. International law, as far as relations of one country to another, countries under no circumstances may interfere in the internal affairs of another country except in self-defense and only if the Security Council authorizes it, no other reason. So the Congress cannot declare war on another country unless the Security Council authorizes that war in self-defense only. Well, of course, America trashes international law, the Constitution, Jim, and U.S. statute laws, and it doesn't just relate to Obama or George Bush. I mean, this is longstanding policy. It goes back a long, long way.
Oh, you're absolutely right, Stephen, and as you may be aware, Richard Silverstein has published a piece, NSA Facility Jerusalem, where it turns out that the NSA has a facility for tracking all of our satellite intelligence, which is the key to our intelligence operations, which the Israelis basically are running, which means that Israel now has access to all American intelligence. This appears to have been an arrangement made by George Herbert Walker Bush. Stephen, I can't tell you how appalling this is. Probably the greatest act of treason of which I have ever heard. I mean, it makes Snowden's revelation pale by comparison. Here you have a president of the United States giving away the American intelligence operation to Israel. This is as disgusting as it gets.
Jim, it really is. And I guess it means that Israel, if it wants to, can be monitoring everything you and I do, our emails, our phone calls, everything. If they have total intelligence awareness, they can get everything. And
Israel, they may even have access to all of our launch codes, Stephen. It's that bad. I mean, this is, you know, that somebody like George Herbert Walker Bush, who was, by the way, involved in the assassination of JFK, he not only supervised the Bay of Pigs, but he was a coordinator of one of the hit teams in Dallas. I mean, this man is disgusting. If you trace the history of the Bush family in American politics, it's like an enormous, ever-growing cancer on the body politic.
Oh, it really is. I think he's in his late 80s now, and I can't wait for the bastard to go. We certainly won't miss him. We're talking about the senior Bush. We're not talking about the junior Bush.
Junior's a dim bulb, and, you know, I don't think he was ever entrusted with anything serious, you know. Even when he was president, Dick Cheney was running the shop.
Absolutely.
You know, Bush was better off in Crawford chopping wood or
if his daddy wasn't the former president and the former CIA director, he never would have gotten into Yale and Harvard. I don't know. It was easy to get in. I guess it was easy to get through and get a degree because your name was Bush. He certainly didn't earn the degrees.
No. He doesn't have the intellectual equipment. He couldn't have passed one of my courses for undergraduates in critical thinking, Stephen. The man is a simpleton, sad to say, but there it is.
Oh, there it is, Jim. Let's briefly cover the Iranian situation because, as you mentioned, and it's absolutely so, it is very clear that Iran does not have a nuclear weapons program. There's no military component to Iran's nuclear program. It's entirely peaceful. Iran was one of the original signatories to the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty back in the 1960s. It's abided by. There's not a shred of evidence to show that Iran does not fully abide by NPT. which it does, and U.S. intelligence says there's no nuclear weapons program, and yet the big lie proliferates about the danger of its nuclear weapons program, and we have this interim agreement drawn up with a time frame by roughly mid-July to come up with a final agreement. And Obama, you know, rhetorically, Jim, is showing outreach to Iran, and yet I'm wondering, is it all hokum? Does he really want to continue the hostility? Does he want an excuse to blame Iran for violating the agreed-on terms as a reason to just go right back to the same old hardline tactics and maybe involve Iran as the next target of America after he finishes up with Syria?
Well, Iran is no pushover. Iran is a powerful nation with a large population and considerable military resources, including the best anti-ship missiles in the world. An attack on Iran would be a calamity. They could sink every single vessel that the United States possesses in the Persian Gulf or in the Mediterranean. I mean, virtually within the first 5 minutes. I mean, Stephen, this is just stupid, and it's incredible that the American government is devolved to the level that it can be contemplating actions against a nation with a great history like Iran, which has not attacked any other nation for over 300 years. Would that that could be said of the United States, even though it has a briefer history. The number of countries we've invaded has been staggering.
Indeed so, Jim. And the real history of Iran is so vastly different than the indications that come across in the U.S. major media, the scoundrel media, and Iranian media. Press TV has you on often, Jim. They have me on often. There's another Iranian service called Fars TV. They have me on. They had me on February 11th, which was the 35th anniversary of the Iranian Revolution. A couple of years ago, they had me on that anniversary as well. I really felt very honored to be an American, to be asked to come on and comment. I got about 15 minutes to comment about the revolution. They brought up comments. They asked some questions. And it was wonderful to be able to discuss that. And, of course, it's a very major occasion for Iran. But it's exactly right. Iran threatens no one. There is no country in the region that feels threatened by Iran. Iran hasn't attacked anybody in centuries. And yet all of this maliciousness get spread around about a country that really wants peace. It wants rapprochement with every country in the world, even with Israel. Its beef with Israel is Iran doesn't want to wipe Israel off the map. Israel wants to wipe Iran off the map. That's Iran's
right.
Beef with Israel.
That's right. And, of course, 9/11 was really a staged event that was rigged in order to instill fear into the American people, make us believe that we were under attack by a foreign power when it was actually orchestrated by the CIA, the neocons, and the Mossad in order to transform our foreign policy from one at which, at least officially, we never attacked any nation that hadn't attacked us first, into one in which we became an aggressor nation, launching an invasion of Afghanistan within 3 weeks of 9/11, and then of Iraq, even though eventually Bush would acknowledge that Iraq had nothing to do with 9/11, that Saddam was not in cahoots with Al-Qaeda. And we also know, of course, that Osama bin Laden had nothing to do with it, as even our own FBI would acknowledge. I mean, the lies, deceit, and deception, Stephen, is endless.
Endless indeed, Jim. Maybe we can segue into 9/11 and then go to Sandy Hook to wrap up the program. Let it be the cleanup hitter in the program. I mean, we're talking, there's really a relation between 9/11 and Sandy Hook, Jim. I mean, two big lies, two elaborate hoaxes. I have to say that certainly 9/11 is the big one. I call it the big lie of our time. I mean, look, all of the horrors that have taken place in the aftermath of 9/11. And Jim, you really are an expert on the topic. You've done extraordinary research on it. Let's go into 9/11. It really is the big lie of our time.
Well, it is, Stephen, and indeed it's been extremely difficult to sort out exactly what happened on 9/11, but I think we have finally managed to do it. I have, since the Vancouver hearings, which were held in June of 2012, during which speaker after speaker substantiated that the destruction of the Twin Towers had been a nuclear event, which is especially supported by the U.S. Geological Survey's own dust samples, which were many and various, and produced elements that would not have been present had this not been a nuclear event, including barium and strontium, lanthanum, lithium, uranium, tritium. I mean, it's just stunning, which I inventoried in an article entitled 9/11 Truth Will Out, the Vancouver Hearings 2. But in the meanwhile, I published a series of articles involving collaboration between multiple experts, including Jeff Prager, Dr. Ed Ward, Don Fox, and others, where elaborating how it appears to have been done by a sophisticated arrangement of mini or micro nukes, where, for example, if you were to blow one cube of 10 floors in a 110-story building per second, then that would take 11 seconds, which is the time estimate by NIST, and where since the South Tower, the top 30 floors were tilted to one side and blown as 19 seconds, so the time requirement would be similar, but where the situation is even more complicated, it appears to be why we've had so much trouble sorting out the difference between big nukes, little nukes, thermite, nanothermite, and even directed energy weapons. The latest article, which has just appeared now, 9/11, a world swirling in a volcano of lies, was precipitated by the reflections of Dennis Camino, who is a longtime military and electronics expert, primarily with U.S. Navy combat systems. He was a Navy top EMI troubleshooter before he went to work for Raytheon in the 1980s. He was reflecting on a photograph from 9/11, showing just these massive volumes of white substance that were pouring out of the towers. I mean, you can find it there. And it turns out that this was hundreds, even thousands of tons of pulverized something called vermiculite. Vermiculite, which is a form of asbestos that was used in the floor slabs of the WTC towers. Now, there was so much of it that he began reflecting on how it would have had to require larger nukes in order to bring this about, that it looked unlikely that mini nukes could account for it. And in fact, I include there a study of the construction of the towers that shows that the steel that was used in the building in the sub-basements was 6 inches thick, then 5 inches, then 4, 3, 2, 1, and so forth, going up to merely a quarter of an inch at the very top. So that what now appears to be the case, Stephen, and this is really fascinating because it reconciles the different theories of how it was done. They appear to have been using the mini nukes to initiate the detonation sequence from the top down, where the floors are blowing apart in every direction. And then as the floors successively were being blown apart, they worked their way down toward the thicker steel, the 3, 4, 5 inch thick steel. And under this umbrella or coverage of this massive debris, which served as a cloak or a shroud or an umbrella, the big nukes were used to take out the heavier steel. So it appears to have been done with a combination of little nukes and big nukes, and where even thermite or nanothermite was used in order to cut some of the floors, joints, and all that as a form of preparation. Which doesn't appear to play a role here is directed energy weapons in the sense that Judy Wood has advocated of some kind of free energy technology that could be land-based, airborne, or space-based. Her hypothesis has always been extraordinarily vague, too difficult actually to even test. She has done a marvelous job of gathering together evidence, but her explanation has never been adequate. And what we now have is actually an explanation where, because these mini or micro nukes are satisfy her definition of a directed energy weapon, which is a source or device that provides much more energy than any conventional source and that can be directed, where these mini or micro nukes satisfy both of those conditions. They provide vastly more energy than conventional weapons, and they can be directed, in particular, upward. So you take out the top cube upward, then the next cube upward, then the next cube upward, and work downward to where then you have the simultaneous upward explosion of the mini nukes meeting the upward explosion from the larger nukes placed lower down to take out the heavier. I think we've actually worked it out, Stephen, and that this is the basis for a reconciliation between all of the competing theories about how it was done. And needless to say, This is nothing within the capability of 19 Islamic terrorists or Osama bin Laden. I mean, that is such a ridiculous poppycock. I can't believe anyone ever believed it. In fact, what you find in this article is a survey of the most recent cutting-edge studies about 9/11. So I highly recommend that everyone in your audience check it out. 9/11, a world swirling in a volcano of lies.
Oh, a volcano of lies indeed, Jim. And, of course, there's always Building 7 that was untouched by the so-called attack. And yet later in the day, the building collapsed. And the BBC, to its shame, I don't know who fed them the information, but they literally reported the collapse of building. I've seen the videotape. I don't know if it's still available. They literally reported the collapse of Building 7 a half an hour before it happened.
That's right. Actually, it was at 4:57, James Standley of the BBC reported that the Solomon Brothers building had collapsed, which because Solomon Brothers owned a big chunk of Building 7, it was commonly referred to that way by the BBC. But over her left shoulder, you could actually see Building 7 standing in the background. It was not going to come down for 23 more minutes until 5:20 in the afternoon. And we know from Barry Jennings, who was a New York City emergency management official, who went into Building 7 that morning and went up to Rudy Giuliani's command and control center, two floors he had there, which had their own air and water supply. He found half-eaten sandwiches and fresh, still steaming coffee. A fireman came along and said, "We got to get you out of here." While he was in the building, explosions were taking place. A stairwell was blown out from under his feet, and he felt himself stepping over dead bodies, though in the pitch blackness he couldn't see them. When he got out of the building, he was interviewed by reporters, and you can still find his interviews on YouTube to this day, as well as of James Standley, Stephen. And the fact of the matter is that the Building 7 wasn't even mentioned in the official 9/11 Commission report. But when NIST did its own separate study about Building 7, would you believe, mysteriously, Barry Jennings died just a couple of days before its publication, where he would have been in the position to contradict its conclusion on his own personal experience.
Pretty disgusting, Jim, and even all these years after the event, the big lie proliferates and the commemorations on the anniversaries of 9/11. You know, they mourn the victims and they hide the truth. It's the same dirty game. Jim, let's take a short break and then we'll come back and pick this up. We'll continue with 9/11. Welcome back. On with James Fetzer. Let's wrap up 9/11, Jim, and then get into so much to talk about Sandy Hook. It may have happened over a year ago, but it's a big, big story. And I'll mention the article that really struck me, Jim, and you've got some new information, and we can get into that. Just briefly wrap up 9/11. The idea that many nukes could have been used, that New York City was nuked, many or otherwise, it really is a shocking revelation if that's exactly what happened.
And, of course, there was voluminous asbestos that was in the atmosphere. In fact, that was a reason why, although the Port Authority had directed that asbestos had to be removed from the Twin Towers, it hadn't been done because the buildings couldn't be destroyed, even though they had tenancy problems, by conventional demolitions, which would have exposed the asbestos into the atmosphere. And to remove it physically would have required erecting steel scaffoldings around 110-story buildings at an estimated expense of about $1 billion. So when Larry Silverstein took possession, the first time they'd come into public ownership, 6 weeks before 9/11, it was clear that those were going to be used as the target for the staged event, and that he immediately fired the security company that had been looking after the towers since they were first opened in 1970 and, did an insurance job whereby he included a clause against terrorist attacks. And because there were purportedly two planes, he claimed double indemnity, so that he made over $4.5 billion return on a $114 million investment. He's not known as Lucky Larry for nothing, Steve.
the dirty story just gets dirtier and dirtier and dirtier, Jim. It's absolutely astonishing. So many links to the 9/11 story, and of course the puts put out on U.S. Airlines, American Airlines, I guess United Airlines. So people cashed in, betting a stock would fall. People cashing in big time because they had inside information. So much more. I mean, advising people to get out of town. I think the mayor of San Francisco, Willie Brown was his name.
Yes, Willie Brown, absolutely.
He was scheduled to go to New York. He was advised not to go on that day. Stuff like that.
I think by Condoleezza Rice, no less. Stephen, it's all complete disgrace from beginning to end. Of course, the fellow they arranged to have as the executive director, Philip Zelikow, was not only from the inner sanctum of the Bush administration, where he'd overseen the transition of the national security apparatus from Clinton to Bush. He not only published articles, even, I think, a book with Condoleezza Rice, but his background as an academician before he entered government, Stephen, was the area of the creation and maintenance of public myths, M-Y-T-H-S. And that's, of course, exactly what he gave us with 9/11, a draft of the report of which he had completed a year before he shared it with any member of the staff.
A shocking story, Jim. Maybe one day the full story will come out and people will know about it. But here, all these years after the event and all the harm that has been done to so many millions of people in the Middle East and in Central Asia, the Afghan people, and the reverberations that really go to, and harm so many other people, Americans at home with the trillions of dollars spent on war making that never went for important things at home. And literally, I mean, Americans have been so grievously harmed by this, and most don't realize the connection between the two. Let's leave 9/11, Jim, and segue to Sandy Hook story.
As we do, let me just mention one or two articles that any of the listeners who want to pursue this could check out. On I've already cited the new article about 9/11 and a swirling in a volcano of lies. But on the politics of 9/11, check out Peeling the 9/11 Onion, Layers of Plots Within Plots, which I co-author with Preston James, that goes through the many convoluted false leads and cul-de-sacs that were issued in order to thwart sorting out who was actually responsible, which was primarily American neocons, the CIA and the Mossad. I just wanted to add that to our discussion.
Oh, absolutely, Jim. The articles you write are so intensively researched, and the one that you wrote on Sandy Hook that just really hit me so strongly. 10 reasons explaining why Sandy Hook was an elaborate hoax, and I mean, you have to wonder whether this guy Adam Lanza, was he a real guy or was he simply an invention? He reminded me of somebody who I think really is a real guy back in Norway, 2011, Anders Breivik, who supposedly by himself murdered 90 children of Norwegian politicians, an impossibility. I don't know how you could load and reload and reload one or two or three weapons to be able to murder 90 children or so off on summer camp or wherever they were. So that was a big lie. I think he's a real person. Let me let you jump into Sandy Hook. You certainly know the story much, much better than I do.
Well, Stephen, there have been several developments in relation to Sandy Hook, the most important by far being the involvement of Wolfgang Halbig from Florida, who is a former Florida state trooper who spent 35 years as a school administrator, including as a principal, and who is a nationally recognized expert on school safety, where Wolfgang has been making repeated inquiries to both the Newtown Bee, but also to the Sandy Hook School Board, and even to the Connecticut State Authorities for more information in response to Freedom of Information requests, because he has reviewed, what took place at Sandy Hook and finds gross discrepancies with what ought to have taken place. In other words, that whatever was happening there, it most certainly was not what one would expect if this had been a bona fide emergency involving the deaths of all of these children. I mean, let me mention some of the questions that he's directed to the school board and to the Connecticut authorities, which, by the way, include requesting the release of an FBI report when President Obama came out and said that he was going to unleash all the resources of the federal government. That included an FBI investigation of Sandy Hook, which, however, has been classified. And Wolf raises a very reasonable question. Why in the world should an FBI report on Sandy Hook be classified? It's been sent only to President Obama, to Attorney General Eric Holder, who, incidentally, had a meeting with Governor Malloy of Connecticut about a month before Sandy Hook. And we have Governor Malloy observing during a press conference that he had been spoken to about something like this happening in the aftermath of the event. Where you have to ask, what did that mean? He was spoken to about something like this happening. Was he told that there would be a slaughter of 20 children, in which case he ought to have taken immediate steps to increase security? Or was he told instead that there was going to be a school drill that was going to be presented as though it had been a real shooting? But Eric Holder and Barack Obama got this, and also former FBI Director Robert Mueller. But Wolfgang very appropriately asked, why hasn't it been released to the public? In fact, the whole business with the public and what has been released is quite bizarre, Stephen, because as we point out in Top 10 Reasons Sandy Hook was an elaborate hoax, even the official report from the state of Connecticut doesn't include the names or the ages or the sex of the victims. I find that stunning. I would bet if you go back through hundreds of years of crime reporting in the United States, with a possible exception to victims of sex crimes, you're going to find the names or the ages or the sex of the victims virtually uniformly. So, you know, there are oddities here right from the beginning. Let me mention some of the observations of Wolfgang, because he is such a marvelous resource. He said, the incident at Sandy, and this is from a letter he sent to the school board, the incident at Sandy Hook Elementary School has caused nothing but panic and fear throughout all schools in our country, and I believe you have a responsibility as board members to tell the truth as to why were no trauma helicopters requested that morning when lives could have been saved? Why no paramedics or EMTs were allowed into the school building? Instead, they were told to set up triage. Who declared all 24 school children and school staff legally dead within the first 11 minutes, since only a doctor can do that, not a police officer for Connecticut state laws? Two children supposedly died at the hospital, which took over an hour to transport. Why? Who did the school board contract to remove all the biohazards from Sandy Hook Elementary School, such as 45 to 65 gallons of blood, brain tissue, and skull fragments, blood splatter, blood carpet removal, and so on, just as they did at Columbine, where he was present at Columbine, all right. He was an expert witness in the Columbine shooting, and he's very familiar with these school shootings. Why was the contractor who installed the security system at Sandy Hook Elementary School, and who was the contractor, and what was the total cost of the project? Copies of the triannual asbestos inspections that must be conducted by a certified inspector from outside the school system, and that all parents must be notified of any asbestos, lead, or any other dangerous substances that could cause harm to children and school staff on an annual basis. I've requested those reports from 2002 through current year 2012. Now, what is so difficult in providing me with those reports, since parents at Sandy Hook should see those every year? Please comply. I am asking you as a former educator, national school safety consultant, to respond to my Connecticut Freedom of Information Act request and return phone calls in a timely manner. I will not stop asking until we see board members have the courage of sharing the proof, the truth. There's more to it. There's more to it, but this is an illustration where I followed up with my own letter to the members of the Newton School Board, saying that as a former Marine Corps officer, retired university professor, and especially a journalist for Veterans Today who's published several articles about the Sandy Hook event, I would like to have your response to what Wolfgang Helbig has addressed to you. Wolf is a former Florida State Trooper, a former school principal, and a nationally recognized expert on school safety. Are you going to respond to his inquiries, or will you pretend you never received them? Now, at my suggestion, the web editor for American Free Press did an interview with Wolf, which you can now find online, including on YouTube, Stephen, under the title, School Safety Expert threatened for questioning Sandy Hook on YouTube, because what happened, Stephen, and this is almost unbelievable, Wolfgang was visited by two homicide detectives from, as I recall, Fort Lauderdale, who were contacting him, they said, on behalf of the Connecticut State Police, who told him that if he continued to raise these questions about Sandy Hook, he would face prosecution. Mm. Can you believe that? This is simply stunning that here you have a national certified expert on school safety raising questions about Sandy Hook, and he's being threatened with prosecution. Now, here are three short stories that have appeared in the news, but where there's a major revelation in the background. The first of these three stories, Stephen, is that a Newtown official, the town's top official, First Selectman Pat Ledora, sent a letter to members of the media last Tuesday thanking them for their, quote, respectful professionalism leading up to and on the one-year anniversary of the Sandy Hook School massacre. What she's really thanking them for is not asking any hard questions and for covering up what actually happened. As I will explain, get this. The Newtown Bee itself now, in a second article, has explained in an article published on December 2nd, 2013, that there was widespread hazardous material in the school, which would have made it difficult, even impossible, to renovate the Sandy Hook School. There was all kinds of asbestos, PC. This is a report that should have been distributed. This is one that Wolf is asking for that they haven't acknowledged or responded to. But there was a whole lot of materials that needed to be removed from the school, but would have been extremely expensive to do so. Third is that our Attorney General, Eric Holder, has announced that he's going to continue to pursue gun control measures, which this all seems to be the core of the matter, gun control measures in order to disarm the American people and subvert our rights under the Second Amendment. Now, get this, Stephen. A new article has appeared entitled The Strange Purchase Date and Price of Sandy Hook Homes. People wonder what's going on here and why any of these individuals would have been motivated to become involved. But get this, 15 of the 20 Sandy Hook child victims, one to two of the seven adult victims, and all six of the Sandy Hook adult non-victims, the Phelps, Gene Rosen, and three selectmen, have their homes, mysterious sale date of December 25th, 2009, with a zero sales price. Get this, even this woman, this select woman, Patricia Ledora, who's now age 70. Let me read the report about this. Ledora is the first selectman and head of Newton's three-member board of selectmen who supervise the administration of the town. Like the other two board members, number 21 and number 22 below, Ledora was elected to a two-year term, December 1st, 2011 to December 1st, 2013, which means the three were in charge of Newtown at the time of the Sandy Hook massacre. All three were recently reelected to another two-year term from December 1st, 2013 to December 1st, 2015. A year ago, when this researcher looked up Ellen P. Ledora on the People search engine, her address was listed as 90 Riverside Road, Sandy Hook, Connecticut, 06482. She checked a year ago and today says owner of record, Robert M. and Ellen P. Ledora. Ownership history, sold to Robert M. and Ellen P. Ledora on December 25th, 2009 for $0. $0. She and the two other selectmen, in other words, were given these homes, which are extremely expensive, for $0. They were all deeded to them on the 25th of December, which, Stephen, interestingly, is Christmas Day of 2009. Who does real estate transactions on 2009? Here's the second member of Newtown's Board of Selectmen, William Rogers, 208 Hattertown Road, Newtown, Connecticut, 06470. The owners identified as William and Maria Rogers. The ownership history sold to William and Maria Rogers on 12/25/2009 for $0. The price history as of April 22nd, 1992, $362,000 for that home. But they got it for $0 on December. That's a pretty nice Christmas present, Steve.
Boy, James, it sure is.
Get this. James Gaston Sr., the third member of Newtown's Board of Selectmen, 18 Main Street, Newtown, Connecticut, 06470. The owner is listed as Stephanie A. Gaston. Ownership history sold to Geffany A. Gaston on December 25th, 2009 for $0. Price history as of 10 to 1992, $262,500. No doubt the value of that property has dramatically increased. Steve, there's a whole lot of corruption going on here. We actually have reports that over $17 million has come in donations for the survivors and families of Sandy Hook. $17 million has been divvied up between the families. And then there are reports that the federal government is providing bonuses to the firemen who are involved from anywhere from $100,000 to $250,000. I'm telling you, that's hush money, Steve, as far as going to the firemen to try to keep people from not talking about Sandy Hook. But we are not going to relent. This was a grotesque stunt. And the next effort of mine is going to be to send this report about the school, the homes and these mysterious sales at these strange prices, which, once again, anyone can look up for themselves. The Strange Purchase Date and Price of Sandy Hook Homes, that's the title, The Strange Purchase Date and Price of Sandy Hook Homes, and you'll find it. The methodology that was used is explained here very carefully, all the steps or stages he went through. He made a list of the names of the Sandy Hook victims, including the 20 school children, the six adults, Nancy Lanza, then he added six more who weren't victims but had played significant roles, Jean Rosen, who lives next to the school, Laura Nick Phelps, parents of unharmed Sandy Hook who gave media interviews, and then the three members of the school board I've gone through. And let me just say about Jean Rosen, I was so troubled by Jean Rosen's story about, six children having been unloaded in front of his home from a bus where the children came in and he gave them orange juice and they played for 15 or 20 minutes with stuffed animals before they began to tell him the story, where he reported he himself had actually heard shooting from the school. So that I asked someone I happen to know, who's the former top shrink for the FBI, if he could give me his analysis of what happened here. And he told me, I mean, he gave me a written report, which I published in an article subsequent to that original article on Sandy Hook, in which he explained that Gene Rosen's story was incredible, that if he had heard shooting, he ought to have called 911 immediately, that if children had exposed to this kind of trauma, they would have been talking about it nonstop from the moment they came into his home, that there was nothing about it that added up. And this is just one more indication of the kind of fraud and fakery to which we have been exposed with Sandy Hook.
Jim, it's amazing. There seems to be one big story after another that is nothing but an elaborate hoax. And most people, they have no idea. We get the major media just regurgitating the official lie. And the Sandy Hook story is a very important story. It doesn't rise to the level of a 9/11, but it's a major story, and it still very much resonates around today. And everything told, the official story, appears to be nothing but a bald-faced lie.
Nothing but a bald-faced lie, and not only is the governor involved, and obviously the attorney general, and I'm convinced President Obama and Robert Mueller, but it turns out that when one of the members of our research group, Kelly from Tulsa, began making phone calls, because she's in a business involved in cleaning up biohazards, and she knew in the case of all this blood and so forth, it had to be done in accordance with very rigid specifications, she began calling government agencies in Connecticut and asking them who had cleaned up the blood, and none of them had the least idea. So she went through three agencies, and they finally directed her to Lieutenant Vance, who was a state trooper who actually threatened anyone who challenged the official narrative of Sandy Hook with prosecution on the day of the event. Stephen, this is one of the most stunning episodes, abuse of position, that I've ever encountered in my life here in the United States, with a state trooper threatening to prosecute somebody who would challenge or raise questions about a horrific event about this that is totally implausible when you look seriously into it. Kelly finally was directed to Lieutenant Vance, And when she asked him who cleaned up the blood, he said, "What blood?" Which I think was a moment of utmost candor, because there wasn't any blood to clean up. Get this. We pursued this further, and I actually made a phone call to one of the agencies at Kelly's suggestion, and I have it recorded. And they told me, you know, when I asked who cleaned up the blood, oh, they said it was a company that actually is run by the brother of the governor. I'm telling you, Steve, this is all elaborate. It's as corrupt as it gets. It's been undertaken to create this very emotional psyop on the American people and instill us with fear. Obama's been using it to deprive Americans of their rights to ownership under the Second Amendment in California and New York. The governors are being very aggressive about it. If anyone asks why they want to confiscate weapons or magazines with a certain capacity and so forth, they simply reply with two words, Sandy Hook. But Sandy Hook was a hoax and a fraud, Stephen, and it's growing bigger by the day.
It really is, Jim, and in your article about the 10 reasons, you say there's no direct proof that 28 people actually died. No video evidence, no photographic evidence, nothing. I mean, we literally don't know. We've got the story, but literally we've got a script with no evidence to back it up.
Yeah, and even Nancy Lanza got her home for free. Again, it's another of these bizarre aspects of the case. We're not going to stop until we get the whole truth about Sandy Hook.
Oh, Jim, I hope you won't. We'll have to talk about this more. We're out of time now, so I've got to sign off. Jim, many, many thanks for coming on.
My pleasure, Stephen, always.